Part 2. The Wanderer. 6. Mogien leaped off his steed before it had its feet on the ground, ran to Rokanan and hugged him like a brother. His voice rang with delight and relief. "By Hendon's lance, Star-Lord, why are you marching naked across this desert? How did you get so far south by walking north? Are you—" Mogien met Jahan's gaze and stopped short. Rokanan said, "Jahan is my bondsman." Mogien said nothing. After a certain struggle with himself, he began to grin. Then he laughed out loud. "Did you learn our customs in order to steal my servants, Rokanan? But who stole your clothes?"
"Ohor wears more skins than one," said Keo, coming with his light step over the grass. "Hail, Fire Lord! Last night I heard you in my mind."
"Keo led us to you," Mogien confirmed. "Since we set foot on Firn's shore 10 days ago, he never spoke a word, but last night on the bank of the Sound, when Leoka rose, he listened to the moonlight and said, 'There.' Come daylight, we flew where he had pointed, and so found you." "Where is Iyat?" Rokanan asked, seeing only Raho stand holding the Windsteed's reins. Mogien, with unchanging face, replied, "Dead. The old Gior came on us in the fog on the beach. They had only stones for weapons, but they were many. Iyat was killed, and you were lost. We hid in a cave in the sea cliffs till the steeds would fly again. Raho went forth and heard tales of a stranger who stood in a burning fire unburnt and wore a blue jewel. So when the steeds would fly, we went to Zagama's fort, and not finding you, we dropped fire on his wretched roofs and drove his herds into the forests, and then began to look for you along the banks of the Sound."
"The jewel, Mogien," Rokanan interrupted. "The Eye of the Sea. I had to buy our lives with it. I gave it away."
"The jewel?" said Mogien, staring. "Semli's jewel. You gave it away? Not to buy your life? Who can harm you? To buy that worthless life, that disobedient half-man? You hold my heritage cheap. Here, take the thing. It's not so easily lost." He spun something up in the air with a laugh, caught it, and tossed it, glittering, to Rokanan, who stood and gaped at it, the blue stone burning in his hand, the golden chain. "Yesterday we met two Olgior and one dead one on the other shore of the Sound, and we stopped to ask about a naked traveler they might have seen going by with his worthless servant. One of them groveled on his face and told us the story, and so I took the jewel from the other one, and his life along with it, because he fought. Then we knew you had crossed the Sound, and Keo brought us straight to you. But why were you going northward, Rokanan?"
To find water."
"There's a stream to the west," Raho put in. "I saw it just before we saw you."
"Let's go to it. Jahan and I haven't drunk since last night."
They mounted the Windsteeds, Jahan with Raho, Keo in his old place behind Rokanan. The wind-bowed grass dropped away beneath them, and they skimmed southwestward between the vast plain and the sun. They camped by the stream that wound clear and slow among flowerless grasses. Rokanan could at last take off the impermasuit and dressed in Mogian's spare shirt and cloak. They ate hard bread brought from Tolan, Pea roots, and four of the stump-winged conies shot by Raho and by Jahan, who was full of joy when he got his hands on a bow again. The creatures out here on the plain almost flew upon the arrows and let the Windsteeds snap them up in flight, having no fear. Even the tiny green and violet and yellow creatures called Kilar, insect-like with transparent buzzing wings, though they were actually tiny marsupials, here were fearless and curious, hovering about one's head, peering with round gold eyes, lighting on one's hand or knee a moment, and skimming distractingly off again. It looked as if all this immense grassland were void of intelligent life. Mogien said they had seen no sign of men or other beings as they had flown above the plain.
"We thought we saw some creature last night near the fire," Rokanan said hesitantly, "for what had they seen?" Kyo looked around at him from the cooking fire. Mogian, unbuckling his belt that held the double swords, said nothing. They broke camp at first light, and all day rode the wind between plain and sun. Flying above the plain was as pleasant as walking across it had been hard. So passed the following day, and just before evening, as they looked out for one of the small streams that rarely broke the expanse of grass, Jahan turned in his saddle and called across the wind, "Ohor, see ahead!" Very far ahead, due south, a faint ruffling or crimping of gray broke the smooth horizon. "The mountains," Rokanan said, and as he spoke he heard Kyo behind him draw breath sharply, as if in fear. During the next day's flight, the flat pampas gradually rose into low swells and rolls of land, vast waves on a quiet sea. High-piled clouds drifted northward above them now and then, and far ahead they could see the land tilting upward, growing dark and broken. By evening the mountains were clear. When the plain was dark, the remote, tiny peaks in the south still shone bright gold for a long time. From those far peaks, as they faded, the moon, Lioka, rose and sailed up like a great, hurrying, yellow star. Feni and Feli were already shining, moving in more stately fashion from east to west. Last of the four rose Heliki and pursued the others, brightening and dimming in a half-hour cycle, brightening and dimming. Rokanan lay on his back and watched, through the high black stems of grass, the slow and radiant complexity of the lunar dance. Next morning, when he and Kyo went to mount the gray-striped windsteed, Jahan cautioned him, standing at the beast's head.
"Ride him with care today, Olhor."
The windsteed agreed with a cough and a long snarl, echoed by Mogian's gray. "What ails them?" "Hunger," said Raho, reining in his white steed hard. "They got their fill of Zagama's Herilor, but since we started across this plain there's been no big game, and these hop flyers are only a mouthful to them. Belt in your cloak, Lord Olhor. If it blows within reach of your steed's jaws, you'll be his dinner." Raho, whose brown hair and skin testified to the attraction one of his grandmothers had exerted on some Angiar nobleman, was more brusque and mocking than most midmen. Mogian never rebuked him, and Raho's harshness did not hide his passionate loyalty to his lord. A man near middle age, he plainly thought this journey a fool's errand, and as plainly had never thought to do anything but go with his young lord into any peril. Jahan handed up the reins and dodged back from Rokanan's steed, which leaped like a released spring into the air. All that day the three steeds flew wildly, tirelessly, toward the hunting grounds they sensed or scented to the south, and a north wind hastened them on. Forested foothills rose always darker and clearer under the floating barrier of mountains. Now there were trees on the plain, clumps and groves like islands in the swelling sea of grass. The groves thickened into forests broken by green parkland. Before dusk they came down by a little sedgy lake among wooded hills. Working fast and gingerly, the two midmen stripped all packs and harness off the steeds, stood back, and let them go. Up they shot, bellowing, wide wings beating, flew off in three different directions over the hills, and were gone. "They'll come back when they've fed," Jahan told Rokanan, "or when Lord Mogian blows his still whistle." "Sometimes they bring mates back with them, wild ones," Raho added, baiting the tenderfoot. Mogian and the midmen scattered, hunting hop flyers or whatever else turned up. Rokanan pulled some fat pea roots and put them to roast, wrapped in their leaves in the ashes of the campfire. He was expert at making do with what any land offered, and enjoyed it. And these days of great flights between dusk and dusk, of constant, barely assuaged hunger, of sleep on the bare ground in the wind of spring had left him very fine-drawn, tuned, and open to every sensation and impression. Rising, he saw that Kyo had wandered down to the lake edge and was standing there, a slight figure no taller than the reeds that grew far out into the water. He was looking up at the mountains that towered gray across the south, gathering around their high heads all the clouds and silence of the sky. Rokanan, coming up beside him, saw in his face a look both desolate and eager. He said without turning, in his light, hesitant voice,
"Olhor, you have again the jewel."
"I keep trying to give it away," Rokanan said, grinning.
"Up there," the Fian said, "you must give more than gold and stones. What will you give, Olhor, there in the cold, in the high place, the gray place, from the fire to the cold?"
Rokanan heard him and watched him, yet did not see his lips move. A chill went through him, and he closed his mind, retreating from the touch of a strange sense into his own humanity, his own identity. After a minute, Kyo turned, calm and smiling as usual, and spoke in his usual voice.
"There are Fia beyond these foothills, beyond the forests, in green valleys. My people like the valleys even here, the sunlight and the low places. We may find their villages in a few days' flight."
This was good news to the others when Rokanan reported it. "I thought we were going to find no speaking beings here, a fine, rich land to be so empty," Raho said. Watching a pair of the dragonfly-like Kilar dancing like winged amethysts above the lake, Mogian said, "It was not always empty. My people crossed it long ago in the years before the heroes, before Halan was built or High Oinhall, before Hendin struck the great stroke or Kyrfiel died on Oran Hill. We came in boats with dragon heads from the south and found in Angien a wild folk hiding in woods and sea caves, a white-faced folk. You know the song, Jahan, the lay of Orhogian? Riding the wind, walking the grass, skimming the sea, toward the star Brehen on Leoka's path. Leoka's path is from the south to the north, and the battles in the song tell how we Angiar fought and conquered the wild hunters, the Olgior, the only ones of our race in Angian, for we're all one race, the Liuar. But the song tells nothing of those mountains. It's an old song. Perhaps the beginning is lost. Or perhaps my people came from these foothills. This is a fair country, woods for hunting and hills for herds and heights for fortresses. Yet no men seem to live here now." Jahan did not play his silver-strung lyre that night, and they all slept uneasily, maybe because the wind steeds were gone, and the hills were so deathly still, as if no creature dared move at all by night. Agreeing that their camp by the lake was too boggy, they moved on next day, taking it easy and stopping often to hunt and gather fresh herbs. At dusk they came to a hill the top of which was humped and dented, as if under the grass lay the foundations of a fallen building. Nothing was left, yet they could trace or guess where the flight court of a little fortress had been. In years so long gone, no legend told of it. They camped there, where the wind steeds would find them readily when they returned. Late in the long night, Rokanan woke and sat up. No moon but little Leoka shone, and the fire was out. They had set no watch. Mogian was standing about 15 feet away, motionless, a tall, vague form in the starlight. Rokanan sleepily watched him, wondering why his cloak made him look so tall and narrow-shouldered. That was not right. The Angiar cloak flared out at the shoulders like a pagoda roof, and even without his cloak, Mogian was notably broad across the chest. Why was he standing there so tall and stooped and lean? The face turned slowly, and it was not Mogian's face. "Who's that? Rokanan asked, starting up, his voice thick in the dead silence. Beside him, Raho sat up, looked around, grabbed his bow and scrambled to his feet. Behind the tall figure, something moved slightly, another like it. All around them, all over the grass-grown ruins in the starlight, stood tall, lean, silent forms, heavily cloaked, with bowed heads. By the cold fire, only he and Raho stood.
"Lord Mogian!" Raho shouted.
No answer.
"Where is Mogian? What people are you? Speak!"
They made no answer, but they began slowly to move forward. Raho knocked an arrow. Still they said nothing. But all at once they expanded weirdly, their cloaks sweeping out on both sides, and attacked from all directions at once, coming in slow, high leaps. As Rokanan fought them, he fought to waken from the dream. It must be a dream. Their slowness, their silence, it was all unreal, and he could not feel them strike him. But he was wearing his suit. He heard Raho cry out desperately, "Mogian!" The attackers had forced Rokanan down by sheer weight and numbers, and then before he could struggle free again, he was lifted up, head downward, with a sweeping, sickening movement. As he writhed, trying to get loose from the many hands holding him, he saw starlit hills and woods swinging and rocking beneath him, far beneath. His head swam, and he gripped with both hands onto the thin limbs of the creatures that had lifted him. They were all about him, their hands holding him, the air full of black wings beating. It went on and on. And still, sometimes, he struggled to wake up from this monotony of fear. The soft hissing voices about him, the multiple laboring wing beats jolting him endlessly on. Then, all at once, the flight changed to a long, slanting glide. The brightening east slid horribly by him, the ground tilted up at him, the many soft, strong hands holding him let go. And he fell. Unhurt, but too sick and dizzy to sit up, he lay sprawling and stared about him. Under him was a pavement of level, polished tile. To left and right above him rose a wall, silvery in the early light, high and straight and clean as if cut of steel. Behind him rose the huge dome of a building, and ahead, through a topless gateway, he saw a street of windowless, silvery houses, perfectly aligned, all alike, a pure geometric perspective in the unshadowed clarity of dawn. It was a city, not a Stone Age village or a Bronze Age fortress, but a great city, severe and grandiose, powerful and exact, the product of a high technology. Rokanan sat up, his head still swimming. As the light grew, he made out certain shapes in the dimness of the court, bundles of something. The end of one gleamed yellow. With a shock that broke his trance, he saw the dark face under the shock of yellow hair. Mogian's eyes were open, staring at the sky, and did not think. All four of his companions lay the same, rigid, eyes open. Raho's face was hideously convulsed. Even Kyo, who had seemed invulnerable in his very fragility, lay still with his great eyes reflecting the pale sky. Yet they breathed, in long, quiet breaths, seconds apart. He put his ear to Mogian's chest and heard the heartbeat very faint and slow as if from far away. A sibilance in the air behind him made him cower down instinctively and hold as still as the paralyzed bodies around him. Hands tugged at his shoulders and legs. He was turned over and lay looking up into a face, a large, long face, somber and beautiful. The dark head was hairless, lacking even eyebrows. Eyes of clear gold looked out between wide, lashless lids. The mouth, small and delicately carved, was closed. The soft, strong hands were at his jaw, forcing his own mouth open. Another tall form bent over him, and he coughed and choked as something was poured down his throat. Warm water, sickly and stale. The two great beings let him go. He got to his feet, spitting, and said, "I'm all right, let me be." But their backs were already turned. They were stooping over Jahan, one forcing open his jaws, the other pouring in a mouthful of water from a long silvery vase. They were very tall, very thin, semi-humanoid, hard and delicate, moving rather awkwardly and slowly on the ground, which was not their element. Narrow chests projected between the shoulder muscles of long, soft wings that fell curving down their backs like gray capes. The legs were thin and short, and the dark, noble heads seemed stooped forward by the upward jut of the wing blades. Rokanan's handbook lay under the fog-bound waters of the channel, but his memory shouted at him. High-intelligence life-forms, unconfirmed species, ?4, large humanoids said to inhabit extensive towns, ? And he had the luck to confirm it, to get the first sight of a new species, a new high culture, a new member for the League. The clean, precise beauty of the buildings, the impersonal charity of the two great angelic figures who brought water, their kingly silence, it all awed him. He had never seen a race like this on any world. He came to the pair who were giving Keo water and asked with diffident courtesy, "Do you speak the common tongue, winged lords?" They did not heed him. They went quietly with their soft, slightly crippled ground gait to Raho and forced water into his contorted mouth. It ran out again and down his cheeks. They moved on to Mogian, and Rokanan followed them. "Hear me," he said, getting in front of them, but stopped. It came on him sickeningly that the wide golden eyes were blind, that they were blind and deaf. For they did not answer or glance at him, but walked away, tall, aerial, the soft wings cloaking them from neck to heel, and the door fell softly to behind them. Pulling himself together, Rokanan went to each of his companions, hoping an antidote to the paralysis might be working. There was no change. In each he confirmed the slow breath and faint heartbeat, in each except one. Raho's chest was still, and his pitifully contorted face was cold. The water they had given him was still wet on his cheeks. Anger broke through Rokanan's awed wonder. Why did the angel men treat him and his friends like captured wild animals? He left his companions and strode across the courtyard, out the topless gate, into the street of the incredible city. Nothing moved. All doors were shut. Tall and windowless, one after another, the silvery facades stood silent in the first light of the sun. Rokanan counted 6 crossings before he came to the street's end, a wall. 5 meters high it ran in both directions without a break. He did not follow the circumferential street to seek a gate, guessing there was none. What need had winged beings for city gates? He returned up the radial street to the central building from which he had come, the only building in the city, different from and higher than the high silvery houses in their geometric rows. He re-entered the courtyard. The houses were all shut, the streets clean and empty, the sky empty, and there was no noise but that of his steps. He hammered on the door at the inner end of the court. No response. He pushed, and it swung open. Within was a warm darkness, a soft hissing and stirring, a sense of height and vastness. A tall form lurched past him, stopped, and stood still. In the shaft of low early sunlight he had let in the door, Rokanan saw the winged being's yellow eyes close and reopen slowly. It was the sunlight that blinded them. They must fly abroad and walk their silver streets only in the dark. Facing that unfathomable gaze, Rokanan took the attitude that Hilfers called GCO, for Generalized Communications Opener, a dramatic, receptive pose, and asked in Galactic, "Who is your leader?" Spoken impressively, the question usually got some response, none this time. The winged one gazed straight at Rokanan, blinked once with an impassivity beyond disdain, shut his eyes, and stood there, to all appearances, sound asleep. Rokanan's eyes had eased to the near darkness, and he now saw, stretching off into the warm gloom under the vaults, rows and clumps and knots of the winged figures, hundreds of them, all unmoving, eyes shut. He walked among them, and they did not move. Long ago, on Davenant, the planet of his birth, he had walked through a museum full of statues, a child looking up into the unmoving faces of the ancient Hainish gods. Summoning up his courage, he went up to one and touched him, her, they could as well be females, on the arm. The golden eyes opened, and the beautiful face turned to him, dark above him in the gloom. "Hassa," said the winged one, and stooping quickly, kissed his shoulder, then took three steps away, refolded its cape of wings, and stood still, eyes shut. Rokanan gave them up and went on, groping his way through the peaceful, honeyed dusk of the huge room till he found a farther doorway open from floor to lofty ceiling. The area beyond it was a little brighter, tiny roof holes allowing a dust of golden light to sift down. The walls curved away on either hand, rising to a narrow arched vault. It seemed to be a circular passage room surrounding the central dome, the heart of the radial city. The inner wall was wonderfully decorated with a pattern of intricately linked triangles and hexagons repeated clear up to the vault. Rokanan's puzzled ethnological enthusiasm revived. These people were master builders. Every surface in the vast building was smooth and every joint precise. The conception was splendid and the execution faultless. Only a high culture could have achieved this. But never had he met a highly cultured race so unresponsive. After all, why had they brought him and the others here? Had they, in their silent, angelic arrogance, saved the wanderers from some danger of the night? Or did they use other species as slaves? If so, it was queer how they had ignored his apparent immunity to their paralyzing agent. Perhaps they communicated entirely without words. But he inclined to believe, in this unbelievable palace, that the explanations might lie in the fact of an intelligence that was simply outside human scope. He went on, finding in the inner wall of the Taurus passage a third door, this time very low so that he had to stoop, and a winged one must have to crawl. Inside was the same warm, yellowish, sweet-smelling gloom, but here stirring, muttering, susurrating with a steady, soft murmur of voices and slight motions of innumerable bodies and dragging wings. The eye of the dome, far up, was golden. A long ramp spiraled at a gentle slant around the wall clear up to the drum of the dome. Here and there on the ramp, movement was visible. And twice a figure, tiny from below, spread its wings and flew soundlessly across the great cylinder of dusty golden air. As he started across the hall to the foot of the ramp, something fell from midway up the spiral, landing with a hard, dry crack. He passed close by it. It was the corpse of one of the winged ones. Though the impact had smashed the skull, no blood was to be seen. The body was small, the wings apparently not fully formed. He went doggedly on and started up the ramp. 10 meters or so above the floor, he came to a triangular niche in the wall in which winged ones crouched, again short and small ones with wrinkled wings. There were 9 of them, grouped regularly, 3 and 3 and 3 at even intervals, around a large pale bulk that Rokanen peered at a while before he made out the muzzle and the open, empty eyes. It was a wind steed, alive, paralyzed. The little delicately carved mouths of 9 winged ones bent to it again and again, kissing it, kissing it. Another crash on the floor across the hall. This Rokanen glanced at as he passed at a quiet run. It was the drained, withered body of a Barillo. He crossed the high, ornate Taurus passage and threaded his way as quickly and softly as he could among the sleep-standing figures in the hall. He came out into the courtyard. It was empty. Slanting white sunlight shone on the pavement. His companions were gone. They had been dragged away for the larvae there in the domed hall to suck dry.